Good morning. It's Sunday, the 7th of April, 2019. Today on Sunday Brunch.
The final shot literally is a pull out of the rainforest, and you see the edge of the rainforest, and there to the horizon is oil palm. Now, that's an engaging story. You know, after a hard day at work, you probably just enjoy the orangutans. But if you listen to the narration, it has far more emotional resonance.
We'll meet the veteran producers behind Sir David Attenborough's extraordinary new documentary series, Our Planet, and find out why they felt they had to embark on the project now. Also today, we'll walk the plank with some of the world's most notorious pirates.
Many of them did quite well, many of them didn't, but it was the time when piracy was at its height. But it certainly was not a golden age for those who were plundered by the pirates.
Plus, the artist Oliver Jeffers explains how politics informs art as his new solo exhibition launches in Mayfair. And Sian Pattenden takes us through the weekend papers. So, pour yourself a coffee. It's time for Sunday Brunch. Good morning, I'm Georgina Godwin. First today, a look at what's making news. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said yesterday that he would annex Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank if he wins another term in office, a last-minute pre-election promise likely to enrage Palestinians and the Arab world. Netanyahu is competing for votes with right-wing parties who support that plan. The settlements are illegal under international law, though Israel disputes this. After weeks of power cuts and limited access to water, tens of thousands of Venezuelans took to the streets yesterday to back opposition leader Juan Guaido and protest against President Nicolas Maduro, whom they accuse of wrecking the economy. On Friday, the US government took another step in its efforts to force Maduro out by imposing new sanctions on Venezuelan oil shipments and promising stronger action against key ally Cuba for helping to keep the government afloat. The group of seven nations ended a foreign ministers' meeting in western France without quarrelling yesterday, as they looked to lay the groundwork for a leaders' summit in August, despite the absence of the US Secretary of State. The group warned eastern Libyan military commander Khalifa Haftar to halt his thrust on Tripoli, menacing the internationally recognised government based there, or face possible international action. The meeting also tackled gender inequality, trafficking in Africa's Sahel region, and the dangers of cybercrime. And Benny Andersson and Björn Ulvaeus from the 1970s Swedish pop group ABBA made a surprise appearance on the stage at the Novella Theatre in London's West End last night for the 20th anniversary of the hit musical Mamma Mia. Andersson and Ulvaeus wrote the music and lyrics to the show, which has been seen by more than 9 million people at three separate venues in London. It's also been made into a hit film. That's your news update. Right, well, our coffees have been delivered courtesy of the Monocle Cafe on Chilton Street here in Malibu, which means it must be time to sit back and have a rustle through the weekend's papers. And helping me to do that is my friend and colleague, Sian Pattenden. Now, Sian, it's very difficult to know where to start with you, Sian. You are a journalist.
They say that, yes.
A broadcaster, a podcaster, an artist, an illustrator, an author. All of these things. My mate, Sian.
Yeah. I can't sit still, basically. It's that, isn't it? Yeah.
Sian, what's caught your eye? I mean, the one story that I notice is all over the front pages is this whole anti-Semitism row involving the opposition Labour Party here in Britain.
Absolutely. It is everywhere. You can't move for it. It's on the cover of the Sunday Times. Labour's hate files expose Corbyn's anti-Semitic army, they're calling it. The Labour Party has failed to take disciplinary action against hundreds of members accused of anti-Semitism under Jeremy Corbyn's leadership. There have been leaked documents, and the story is that nothing has happened, but that's the big story, is nothing has happened. No one has been hauled over the coals over what is a simmering row that has been going on for seemingly years now, since Jeremy Corbyn really took over the reins.
And so the main complaint seems to be that this probably was brought to his personal attention and his office had taken no action at all. And so any defence of, well, we didn't know what was going on, seems to have fallen away by the leaking of these files.
Yes, it looks like it's going to further divide the Labour Party as well, split as they are. Tom Watson is quoted as saying, this makes for deeply shocking and depressing reading. Labour members in the Jewish community will not understand how, many years on from the first concerns, we've not got to grips with it. So again, it's going to be talks where they're all, you know, there is no solid party line on this. I mean, absolutely. And I say, if things weren't bad enough, there's still more split. And Labour are just in crisis. And I don't know how they get out of something like this. It's a really big eruption.
We're very carefully staying clear of the Brexit side of the story. Of course, Jeremy Corbyn was approached by Theresa May, and it looks like those talks have gone nowhere.
Disappointing is what what people are saying. That's what's been quoted. And most of the papers have run with a story again, which is still not really a story, is that there's a really, the damp squib in the room.
So it remains to be seen what happens tomorrow, of course. Yes. Very important day in Parliament. Mm-hmm. We're all jolly good chaps and we're all safe, apparently. What's this all about?
Absolutely. Well, Prince William, the Duke of Cambridge, has been posited, I think he's finished though, so it's not a secret anymore, at MI5, MI6 and GCHQ for 3 weeks earlier this year. I think presumably to learn about being one of a team, he says in a quote here, something that my other job doesn't necessarily do. So he's been given them, obviously, the nation's secrets, and has potted about and probably made some cups of tea while people didn't tell him what was really going on. But it's so 1950s, isn't it? Or maybe earlier. It's all right, everybody. Don't worry. Prince William's going to save us all. Here he is. Yes, and that's everywhere in the papers. Every single paper has got it. He insisted he wanted to feel less royalty and more spook. Insiders said he even had a canteen lunch every day.
Oh, my. How very egalitarian, I think.
Absolutely. And this also chimes, there was a story earlier this week about the secret spy building that is between a pub and a Starbucks in St James's Park, which everyone knew was a secret spy building that no one really said. And that came out this week. I rather like it. It's sort of trying to, I don't know, rally us round if something terrible happens.
Well, at least Prince William will look after us. More stories about ISIS brides, jihadi brides, and how they have tried to escape, apparently, but have been threatened that their children will be harmed if they leave.
Absolutely. So I think that this is not going to be the first type of this story. Obviously, we had the story earlier in the year, but someone else has come out and is talking to the media actively. Tuba Gondal, who studied English at university, who comes from Britain, loved nightclubbing. She says she repeatedly tried to leave her fellow jihadists in Syria, but felt trapped because there were threats on her children's life. I feel British, she said in an interview. I know the British public is scared of us. They don't want to deal with this, but they must. And I think this is a huge issue, and she's not going to be... You know, we've got a couple of voices, but I think more and more people will come forward. Women may come forward when they feel, when they've seen these sorts of stories and feel that there's more confidence. It's actually an enormous problem. Yes, those people did go and join ISIS or married people were part of it, but there's a great deal of talk about brainwashing, and there's a very, very young girls, they're teenagers, 14 and 15, who are leaving. So I think it's going to be something that moves on and on, and we'll see more voices.
And wouldn't you rather have them back here and try and perhaps undo some of that brainwashing than have them outside absolutely hating Britain?
It's a very sensitive issue, though, as we know, and legally I think there are few precedents, and the Home Office is doing one thing and the lawyers are doing other, so it will roll on.
Yeah. Now, The Observer has a huge special report, a big pullout on India's strongman. Can Narendra Modi persuade a huge divided country to back him again? Of course, he has many problems facing him, religious conflicts, whole thing about different castes and the antagonism between them, economic fears, 900 million voters in India. And so, obviously, this is a huge issue. About whether he can hold on to it or not. When there is an election, then they don't say I'm untouchable. They put me in a line with everybody else, says one person. This is to do with the caste debate. It's a big pullout and a very, very interesting special report here on Narendra Modi. And finally, what else are we looking at?
Well, another serious story. The Libya fighting at the moment could trigger the new refugee crisis, says EU. So forces loyal to Libya's beleaguered UN-backed government carried out airstrikes yesterday. It's something where, you know, we get to this point and then we see that there are real fatalities, there's a real consequence, there's, you know, that...
The G7 have warned the general, as we were reporting a little bit earlier, Khalifa Haftar, that he must not continue to thrust towards Tripoli. Otherwise, there will be international comeback on that. And finally, there was a story about Malawi.
There is a story about Malawi. Malawi's albinos are being killed for political lucky charms, which is just... heartbreaking, complicated, and the panic is now obviously extended to people. The Sunday Telegraph reports that mothers are having to make a Sophie's choice about fleeing their homes and which of their children to take and which not. And as I say again, war is about prizes, isn't it? It's about the trophies that you take, and this is just a very heartbreaking story. It's obviously not something that gets smashed on page one of everything, but it's a really good read in the Sunday Telegraph and shines light on the Malawi political situation, economics, and what's going on there.
Great. Sian, we're going to get you back in to have a look through some of the cultural pages a little bit later on. But for the rest of you, do stay with us as we take a moment to tuck into our cinnamon buns, because up next, we're taking to the high seas with a rogues gallery of notorious pirates. This is Sunday Brunch.
Tune in to the Monocle Daily on Monocle 24, weekdays at 2200 London time. We unpack the stories that have been dominating the discussion in Europe and North America and set the agenda for a new day in Asia. The show features regular insights and analysis from Monocle's bureau in Toronto and New York, special guests there and across the Americas, as well as experts and analysts at our studios in London. Whether it's industry-focused reports on anything from art and architecture to business and entertainment, or a light-hearted guide to how to spend the perfect weekend in a great city somewhere in the world, you're in good hands. Monocle's network of global correspondents are your guides. Join our team every weekday for the Monocle Daily on Monocle 24.
Minutes past 10 here in London, and today's Sunday Brunch weekend read takes us to the high seas. This week we met best-selling author Eric J. Dolan, whose latest work, Black Flags, Blue Sea, is all about pirates.
The book is sort of broken down into two different sections. Of course, they were all English at this time because the colonies were part of England. Before 1700s, most of the pirates that I talk about were the so-called Red Seamen who went around the Cape of Good Hope into the Indian Ocean, where they attacked Mughal shipping transiting between India and the Red Sea ports of Jeddah and Mocha. And then they often came back to the colonies, settled back into the communities of which they were a part, and often with their riches. And then there's the other section of piracy in the book, which is in the 1700s, which is the one that people are more familiar with. And that is a time when there were no longer these Red Seamen going to the Indian Ocean, but instead pirates who used to spend the winters in the Caribbean would come up north in the summer and attack ships off the American colonies. And whereas before, the Red Seamen were often welcomed colonists because they brought things of great value to the colonies, treasure and goods and East Asian goods. Now in the 1700s, the pirates that were attacking ships off the American coast, they were threatening England's and the colonies' bottom line. So they were attacked, and that's sort of when the Great War on Piracy took place. There's also another minor war against piracy in the late 1600s, which did help to eradicate the Red Seamen who were causing great problems for England because they were attacking ships from the Indian Empire, which was the foundation of the East India trade, which was a bulwark of the English economy. So the book covers a couple of different areas, and it was golden for the pirates, in a sense, that many of them did quite well, many of them didn't, but it was the time when piracy was at its height. But it certainly was not a golden age for those who were plundered by the pirates.
Because some of them were very cruel. I mean, we hear awful tales of torture and so on.
Yes, absolutely. There were some pirates that were so cruel they had to be psychopathic, sadistic individuals. One of them that I talk about is Edward Lowe, who seemed to relish torturing and killing his victims. One of his signature moves was cutting off people's lips and ears and roasting them and then forcing the victims to eat their flesh. But I also want to point out that contrary to popular belief, most pirates were not vicious to the people that they plundered. Every once in a while, pirates would attack and kill individuals and thereby maintain their threatening brand identity, which would, in effect, get most people who were approached by a pirate ship to voluntarily surrender rather than fight. So most of the time, pirates were able to succeed through intimidation. But when intimidation didn't work and people put up resistance, then pirates were very willing to attack and in many cases kill and maim their opposers.
I mean, you highlight several extraordinary characters such as Blackbeard.
Yeah, Blackbeard, he's probably the most famous pirate now, in certainly in America, which is interesting because his career was very short. He didn't manage to accumulate a huge amount of wealth. He was not nearly as vicious as people paint him out to be. But I think the reason that he has stayed in people's minds in part is his name, Blackbeard, but also is in part the rather dramatic portrayal of Blackbeard that appeared in the book by Charles Johnson in 1724, The General History of Pirates, which added to the mythology of Blackbeard and made him a larger-than-life character. But he did have a very dramatic end where he fought British Naval Lieutenant Robert Maynard off the coast of Ocracoke in North Carolina. And unfortunately for Blackbeard, he was on the losing end of that battle. And after the battle, Maynard severed Blackbeard's head, hung it up from the bowsprit of his sloop. And then, according to legend, they pitched Blackbeard's headless body into the murky waters of Pamlico Sound, where it took a few laps around the sloop before sinking from sight. So Blackbeard has a very dramatic history that's come down to us, but he is by far not the most successful of pirates.
Gosh, really very gruesome. There are many stereotypes that we associate with piracy. I mean, you know, the treasure map marked with an X, the parrot that says pieces of eight, the eye patch and all the rest of it. You go a lot deeper than this. There's an analysis of the economic and the class issues of the time.
Right. In many cases, these pirates came from relatively poor backgrounds. Many of them were on merchant ships where they were treated rather horrifically by their autocratic captains, and they rose up and mutinied and decided to go into piracy. Many other pirates came from the ranks of the Navy during times of war. As your listeners well know, privateering became a major endeavor, and it's sort of called license piracy because people and merchant ships were able to get these letters of marque from the government to attack the enemies of that government during times of war. But then once the war was over, the privateering license or letter of marque was yanked, and those individuals were suddenly out of work. And many of them took their hard-won skills of privateering and just transferred them to the realm of piracy. Another aspect, socioeconomic aspect of piracy, had to do with what it was like in the colonies before 1700. This is a time when many colonies didn't feel rather warmly towards the mother country, which sort of was treating the edges of empire rather shabbily. The navigation laws restricted what kind of trade the colonies could engage in. The colonies were often starved for currency. Many of the colonial governors that were sent over there were sort of impoverished aristocrats who were looking to use the colonies as their personal piggy bank. And all of these factors swirl together to create a system in which the colonies, out of a desire to get currency and get these East Indian goods, they decided to go into piracy. And it wasn't viewed that negatively by the colonies because they were going halfway around the world to attack quote-unquote heathens and infidels, the Muslims who were transiting between India and the Red Sea ports of Jeddah and Mocha. And then they were bringing those riches back to the colonies, and in effect, the colonies were thumbing their nose at the mother country, because the mother country didn't want that trade to continue because it was damaging the valuable East India trade. But the colonists, it was almost an early rendition of what took place during the American Revolution, where they were going their own way and they were willing to take actions that were not in line with a government that gave them no representation.
Quite extraordinary. I wonder about the research for this. I mean, you must have had to do a huge amount. And I wonder what was available to you.
There's a lot available. Unfortunately, pirates did not tend to write their own memoirs. So a lot of what you get about the pirates comes through in the trial records and the voluminous correspondence that took place between the colonies and the mother country. And one of the great things about the National Archives in your country is that they are so extensive and so well maintained. So I had amazing access to hundreds of thousands, literally hundreds of thousands of letters that had been written by colonial governors, merchants, customs officials to England during the 1600s and the early 1700s, talking about this bane of piracy. And then I also had the benefit of seeing the letters that were sent back by the Crown, Parliament, Lords of Trade in return. And the archives has been kind enough to put all of those online. They're digitized and searchable. But I also spent a week in London at the archives doing research. Other than that, there is a ton of trial records that give you a lot of insights into piracy. And also, this is a time in the early 1700s when newspapers were starting to take off. So there are a lot of newspaper accounts of what pirates were up to.
Tell me, in your research, did you find any pirate maps with X marks the spot? And is there still treasure out there?
Well, if I did find them, I certainly wouldn't tell you and your listeners because I have to keep it to myself. But no, unfortunately, that is one of the myths of piracy. There are, as far as I know, not a single pirate map has ever come to light that is legitimate. And certainly there's no evidence that any pirates during the Golden Age buried treasure anywhere. Because why would they? Many pirates like to spend their money often as fast as they got it. Also, if you were to bury your treasure, there's no guarantee that you are going to be able to get back to that spot at a later date to retrieve it. And there's always the possibility that somebody else might find it. And Captain William Kidd, of course, is the most famous example of people who have claimed Captain Kidd buried treasure all the way from Delaware up to Oak Island, Nova Scotia. And hundreds, if not thousands, of people have spent years and a lot of money searching for Captain Kidd's hidden hoard, but coming up empty. And I am sure they will continue to find that to be the net result, because I don't think there were any pirates who buried their treasure.
Thanks to Eric J. Dolan, author of Black Flags, Blue Sea. You're listening to Sunday Brunch. Last week, a new report revealed Canada's climate is warming twice as fast as the rest of the world. That's alarming, but not surprising given how often we read and perhaps ignore stories about climate change. The producers of a new documentary series are hoping to shine a brighter light on the issue. Our Planet is narrated by Sir David Attenborough. It's not just about climate change, but the issue overshadows much of the series. Monocle's Ben Ryland met the producers of the series, Keith Scully and Alistair Fothergill, who also created the original Planet Earth series for the BBC. He started by asking them why Our Planet needed to be made.
We realise that actually the world is changing, and the whole attitude towards nature and the natural world is that there is genuine concern about the way things are going. And we wanted to make a big landmark natural history series, but was of our time and relevant to the issues of our time. And so that's why the series running through it has an environmental theme, which takes you through the issues nature faces, but also the solutions to fixing those issues.
There have been several other series in recent times that have really captured attention. One-off documentaries and documentary series that really take us around the globe and really present things in a really beautiful light. But the idea of climate change hasn't always been front and centre of those other series. And it has got people talking. It's got people understanding different aspects to our world and why it should be considered so precious. But it hasn't been front and centre. This new series, Our Planet, it struck me as being a little bit different in tone. It's impossible to watch this without feeling as though, oh gosh, we are on the edge of something quite scary.
Well, I was involved with Blue Planet and Planet Earth and Frozen Planet, working with Keith on these original BBC documentaries. And when we finished Frozen Planet, which was about the poles in around 2012, we both sat down and said the time had come to do a big landmark blue chip mass audience series that for the first time tried to deal with the challenges to the planet. We felt that it had to be done because of the threats we were seeing and how the planet was changing. We also thought that the public were ready for it. There was real interest in the subject matter. At the same time, we want the series, and we believe the series is very entertaining, very educational. But yes, we have for the first time dealt in depth with the challenges the planet faces, because they're very important, they're very critical. But we've also given people solutions, because the TV series, in fact, the tip of a big iceberg. There's a large website we're doing with World Wildlife Fund, ourplanet.com, that gives so much more information, and a very important part of that information is what people, individuals, can do to help the planet.
How do you go about getting those messages across without necessarily... Well, I suppose, look, from my perspective, it must be a very delicate process, because you don't necessarily know why people have come to watch your documentary, do you? You can be appreciative that they have, but you don't know whether they've come to just switch off from the world and be taken somewhere else, or whether they are politically aware and they want something politically explosive put before them, or whether they're trying to simply turn away from all of that. How do you balance those two things, this idea that people might want to be entertained, but you also want to give them a little extra something as well, information?
I think that was the hardest challenge of the series, and we agonized over that, because absolutely, you want to reach a lot of people. So if you want to do that, you want to give them beautiful things and see the beauty of the world, which is very important. I think what happened in the end was quite interesting, that because we picked sequences and stories that actually naturally took you to a place which illustrated change, illustrated solutions, I think what we found is it's actually made the stories of each episode far more interesting. So I hope we've hit the win-win place where people can luxuriate in nature, but they can learn a bigger story, which is not necessarily always depressing. Sometimes it's shocking. Sometimes it's inspirational. But one way or the other, it's a story. And I think that's been the real success of this particular series.
Well, as you say, there is plenty of light and dark, especially in the first episode. There is this terrifying moment involving all of the glaciers, and you see these massive chunks of ice crashing down into the ocean. You get a really good sense for just how big they are. And I was thinking, as the narration tells you, that some of these giant pieces of ice are as big as skyscrapers in a city. If a skyscraper falls down in a city, I mean, we're all going to know about it, aren't we? And yet these giant pieces of ice are falling off all over the place. And it doesn't really hit us until you watch a documentary like this one. I mean, is that part of how you see your challenge, to take these monumental moments that happen out in nature, and perhaps they're only noticed as they're happening by a couple of birds, but to us humans, those moments really add up to be monumental moments in human history?
Most people live in cities. I think now over 90% of the global population live in cities. And so increasingly mankind and womankind is removed from nature. And yet we're totally dependent on nature, you know. And yes, that glacier in Greenland, the Stor Glacier, is the fastest calving glacier in the world. It's calving twice as fast as it used to 10 years ago. And people say to us, have you seen global warming? Have you seen climate change? Well, it's quite a hard thing to film, because it's things that takes tens, hundreds of years to take place. But when you see a glacier carving like that, it's unbelievably dramatic. But that same episode starts with an extraordinary seabird colony off Peru, you know, 5 million seabirds together. And we chose that to say there are still amazing spectacles out there. You know, there is so much still to save and to value. But it is at a critical moment. There's absolutely no doubt that what mankind does in the next 20 years is really, really important. And it's not just about preserving
tigers and elephants. It's not the nice to have, it's about the must have biodiversity on which mankind ultimately is dependent.
We've talked a lot about the epic nature of the program, but we should point out that there are actually many, many little tiny moments that they can only be experienced, I think, through the nature of what you've created here. And one of the moments that sticks out for me are the wonderful little birds, and you'll have to help me with the name that they escaped me.
Yeah, yeah. Mannequins, yes.
Mannequins.
Mannequins, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So these are the birds that have a special little dance. And we follow three different kinds of the birds, and they all show off their particular little dance. I wonder, technically speaking, how do you get to the moment where you can actually film that happening? And I mean, when you go into this, you might know you want to do something like that, but can you be sure that you'll actually be able to capture those moments?
I mean, the journey starts with there's a scientist who will have studied those birds, and they know the display sites, and they know where it's happened. So they're really, really crucial to help us to step one. And then basically the camera team, the cameraman especially, extremely experienced at filming those things, knows where he sets his hide or blind up, and then they just sit and wait for that moment to kind of happen and to sort of capture it. So it's a kind of a series of skills down the kind of line. And in another episode we filmed a bird of paradise dancing, which is for the first time. And what was very interesting with that is that to understand the dance and what it means, you have to see it from the perspective of the female who sits on a branch above him as he's doing his dance. So the team very cleverly fixed a camera above her to look down. And what is revealed is amazing because you actually get her view, and her view is very, very special.
They're extraordinarily intimate moments with some of these animals. Some of them, we're watching moments take place with animals who are actually on the move. And, I mean, I'm going to ask you a technical question again, because I was looking at that thinking, oh, they've done it with drones, obviously. But then again, surely the noise of the drone would be scaring the animals away. Is there a special kind of way that you need to approach these animals to get as close as you want to get without necessarily interfering with the process by making the animal aware that you're present?
I mean, the first rule for wildlife filmmaking is never disturb the animals. So that's the absolute starting point. There is an amazing sequence in the opening episode of hunting dogs running down wildebeest, chasing wildebeest in the Serengeti. And if you see that sequence, as a viewer, you are literally running with the dogs. You're running with the wildebeest. The camera is, as you say, is permanently on the move. And to achieve that, we took a gyro-stabilized camera system that we had originally developed for helicopters on the Planet Earth series. And what that allows you to do is to use a very, very powerful lens, but stabilize it in a bumpy situation, like on a helicopter or mounted on a vehicle driving at 40 miles an hour across a rough grassland. And it takes out all the vibrations. So you can be 150 meters away from the hunting dogs, the wild dogs, but you have their head in full focus. And what it does to the audience, who doesn't know about the technology, but you are running with the dogs, and that's really, really important. We took that same technology and mounted it on a tracked snow machine in Svalbard in the high Arctic, and that allowed us to track with a polar bear. Now, why do you want to have a moving image of a polar bear? Well, the Inuit name for a polar bear is the wanderer. And these bears have enormous territories. A male polar bear in the high Arctic can have a 50,000 square mile territory, one bear. And they are always on the move. And to capture the spirit of the polar bear, you need a moving shot. The other thing which has been really important to this series has been 4K drones. And in the open ocean, where you're out there trying to film very unpredictable, ephemeral events, there are no water holes to go to, there's no feeding tree, it can happen anywhere. You're so far out, waiting for something that may happen in just 20 minutes, you could never get a conventional helicopter there. But using a drone that can take off in seconds, you're over the action. There's an amazing sequence of bluefin tuna, these massive tuna hitting anchovies, all taken from the air, and you can see all the action. We filmed for the very first time blue whale calves, newborn calves with their mothers swimming. And this unbelievably intimate image of the largest animals ever lived on our planet. So technology is important.
We talk about this in technical ways, I think, a lot. And even people's perceptions of what a nature documentary is often comes down to technicalities. It's about learning, it's about education, informing yourself. But when I watch your series, what strikes me is that there's actually lots of individual little stories happening here, and they often, in one episode, let alone in one series, you can go over many different genres of storytelling. There's some romance in there, some drama, and then there's suspense and a thriller as well. How do you go about crafting that story once you've been out there and you've captured everything and you've come back and no doubt you've got a flood of stuff that you need to go through and work and make sense of it? How do you go about crafting the individual stories so that there is this thriller happening with the hunting dogs, and then there's a bit of the romance happening with the birds doing their dances as well?
Especially with this series, because it was so important to have the bigger environmental story running through each episode, we thought long and hard before we picked each sequence. So, in a way, each sequence we picked needed to do a number of jobs. It needed to thrill or entertain or surprise the audience. But then it needed to tell a bigger story, which would build to the whole of the kind of episode. And sometimes, actually, our researchers came up with absolutely wonderful things, amazing things. But we thought, no, but that doesn't really fit in to the overall narrative of what we're trying to sort of do. So I think a lot of it was all about the choices we made. Then always with natural history, you go out there and you film stuff. And then sometimes just crazy things happen, which you never imagined. But then you weave that back in. And that often gives each little scene a kind of an edge and a kind of a spin that even we never had imagined. So there is a lot of planning, but there's also serendipity that can make the sort of difference to how the thing ends up in the end of the show. Programs always have a little life of their own, and a good program, you know, it kind of comes a little creature and it ends up being what it is, and that's the most exciting thing of filmmaking.
Even though our stars obviously don't read the script, we actually go to the field with really detailed storyboards, because you're right, this is cinema, it's drama, and emotion is what drives viewers, and it's really important. And the natural world has the best stories in nature. You know, they are the best stories out there. And our challenge is to tell them in exciting ways, and that's in storyboarding the story. It's about the way you shoot it, but also the way you edit it and the sound effects. And the score is a very, very important part of our films. We're very fortunate on this series to work with Stephen Price, who's an extraordinary Oscar-winning composer. He did Gravity, among other movies, and he's done an amazingly emotional score, which we think is a very important part of engaging the audience in the narrative.
How much do you know about where everything is going when you sit down to piece it all together? Because I know you've spoken wonderfully about the importance of crafting a story. But the thing, of course, about fictional stories is that often the writer will know exactly where they're going. They'll know the end point before they've even begun with the starting point. I imagine that's not so easy for you. You're dealing with wild animals. How deliberate is the storytelling process, and to what degree are you aiming to make sure that whatever you're telling gets to some sort of bigger truth? It's not just about these two flamingos. It's actually telling an overarching story about nature more broadly.
I think that's our key skill, is to manage the unpredictability of nature. You know, when we go out, we've researched a story inside out. We know potentially what the narrative is about, what we want to achieve. But as Keith was explaining earlier, it's 10 or 11 sequences in each show, and there has to be a narrative that builds through the show. And for this series particularly, we wanted sequences that had an environmental resonance. To give you an example, in the jungle, the tropical forest film, it ends with an extraordinary piece of behavior of orangutans in Sumatra, one of the few remaining really healthy populations of orangutan. And we were fascinated by a behavior that only this particular group of orangutans do, which is that the females fish for ants with sticks. Now, it takes about 8 or 9 years for them to learn that, because they're a similar sort of lifespan to human beings. And that's an amazing piece of behavior. But what the narration says is that you know, this is the last generation of orangutans, probably. We're pretty sure that orangutans will be extinct within the next 30 or 40 years. So when you look at a 2-year-old, 3-year-old orangutan trying to learn how to fish with its mother, we can accurately say that this orangutan will not survive into extensive adulthood. And the last shot of the sequence is pulling out, and we have the big male, the oldest member of the troop, who, you know, when he was a baby, the rainforest just stretched to the horizon, and now that isn't the case anymore. And the final shot literally is a pull out of the rainforest, and you see the edge of the rainforest, and there to the horizon is oil palm. Now, that's an engaging story. You know, after a hard day at work, you probably just enjoy the orangutans. But if you listen to the narration, it has far more emotional resonance.
Keith Scully and Alistair Fothergill, producers of the new documentary series Our Planet, which is narrated by Sir David Attenborough. It's out now on Netflix. Up next, Sian Pattinden returns for a look at the weekend's culture pages.
Get ready for a fresh new look. We've moved our printing from the UK to Germany. You'll notice the pictures are crisper and the print is sharper. In this fashion-forward issue, we meet the president of Taiwan as she gears up for the 2020 election and hop on a Finnish icebreaker. We take stock of the business of retail in our annual survey, fly around the world to meet the documentary filmmakers of the moment, and review the last column, reminding us of the importance of a free press. We cross bridges and sit down with Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, visit a Spanish town famous for its sugary treats, and bring you the latest fashion news from around the world in our style directory. Plus, an interview with Loewe's creative director, Jonathan Anderson. Further along, we show you what not to miss in Madrid, check in on the latest hotel openings, and delve deep into everything Texas has to offer. It's a whirlwind tour around the world, printed in Germany. Monocle's April issue is out now. Get your copy today or subscribe at monocle.com.
It's 10:40 in London. If you're just joining us, good morning. You're listening to Sunday Brunch on Monocle 24. I'm Georgina Godwin, and I'm joined once again by Sian Pattinden. Nearly changed your gender and everything as well as your name. Sian Pattinden, for a look through the weekend's cultural pages. Sian, as I was telling listeners earlier, is multi-talented. She's a journalist. She's an illustrator. She is an author. She's a podcaster and all number of things. She's also my neighbour, actually. Interestingly enough, another of our neighbours is actually in the culture pages.
She is Madeline Vriesendorp, who is an architect but also an artist and lives up the road. I've been to her house, is in the Observer Design Special this week, and I will get it just for that, and I will be getting it just for that. It has pictures of the inside of her house. It talks about the sculptures that she makes, which are usually about milk bottles, from, you know, squirty cleaners. She takes the squirty things and makes bouquets of flowers with them. She has these hand sculptures. She's incredible. She's in her 80s now, but she is an absolute inspiration. It's also got her famous frog and crocodile game, which she makes out of squirty cream tops, if you see what I mean, that hide the frog and the crocodile, which I played when I went to her house. She is incredible. I would get it just for that. Madeline Vriesendorp.
She does sound wonderful. And there are a lot of pictures there. And
yes, she's also a surrealist artist. She was part of a big architectural Dutch movement in the 60s. And yes, she's just absolutely wonderful. And still wonderfully, at her age, has all of her marbles, if not more. So, as I say, I take a lot from her. So I'm really excited to see her in the Observer. It's there for everybody to get. It's not in the Architectural Digest, which she's usually in. So it's great.
Excellent. What else do we have?
Well, Fleabag, the hit show that I believe you've been watching,
I
Georgina.
I have. And what's really, really unusual for me is that I hardly ever watch television because I'm always have to be reading just for work. And I just have hit a brick wall the other day and just thought, I just have to stop and do absolutely nothing. And somebody recommended Fleabag. Well, I've basically done nothing else for the past 48 hours but laid on my bed and watched Fleabag. And it's extraordinary. I think it's really good.
I like it, but I have a few problems with it. I have a fourth wall problem with it, but that's well known. So.
Oh, you see, I love her breaking of the fourth wall. I think that works so well.
But the elements of it I love. What I really love is that campaigners are delighted that this is trying to change the Vatican's attitude to sex, maybe, because we have the sexy priest in it.
Yeah, so let's just... This is by the actress and writer Phoebe Waller-Bridge. So she wrote this originally as a script. She took it up as a stage show to the Edinburgh Festival. And did very well there, and then has turned it into this television series. She's also one of the writers on Killing Eve, I think.
She is the main writer on Killing Eve, yes.
And she has another series out too about Property Guardians, I think.
That's going to come out soon. Yes, she is the hottest new thing.
Yeah.
And she really is someone that everybody is talking about and leading the way as a subversive woman in comedy, which is good to see.
Just talking about her taking that play up to Edinburgh, I understand you were the youngest playwright ever to have something on the Edinburgh Fringe stage.
I was, and I don't know if that has been trumped. I need to ask. At 16, I wrote a play. I wrote it as part of a Soho theatre workshop, and a director rang me up who'd been working with me at the workshop and said, can I take your play to Edinburgh? Do you want to finish it? And it was about a boy who wanted to be a feminist. It was so before its time in the 80s. And he's not really a very good feminist, and he goes to Greenham Common, and it was a comedy, and a comedy of errors. Yes.
Oh, fantastic.
And I recently got back in touch with the director and we're going to meet up, which is really lovely. She's in Scotland.
Was that before or after you were in Doctor Who?
That was after I was in Doctor Who.
She's very interesting. We'll come back to her another time. Sian, so that's Fleabag, which is, as you were saying, is exploring these ideas of religion, because there's a sexy priest in it and the Catholic
Church.
It's also
it's not just so facile. It is all about her quest for something else, some calm, some sense, some order. So it makes sense within the whole narrative plot.
Yeah, absolutely. Right, moving on.
Moving on, we have an article by someone in this room. You, Georgina, yesterday in The Times, you reviewed, and I really want to read it, 2 weeks in November, Douglas Rogers' story.
Oh, so now this is
Mugabe.
So interesting. So, I mean, I think people will remember that we, on this station, and of course all of the media, were reporting what Zimbabweans were very careful to call not a coup. Because, of course, if it had been a coup, then regional bodies and so on would have had to have gotten involved in the takeover. This was November 2017 in Zimbabwe. But it was, of course, a coup by not that name. And what Douglas Rogers has done, he's a Zimbabwean writer. His past book was called The Last Resort, about his parents' tourist lodge. He has unpicked exactly what was going on behind the scenes, which is so interesting. This coup essentially kind of plotted in Johannesburg, a lot of different people from different political points of view coming together to decide what to do, how to change the regime. Mostly, I think that this is, you were talking about feminism earlier, and the coup was sort of triggered by the fact that the vice president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, who is now the president, was fired. The reason he was fired was that Grace Mugabe's wife, no longer wanted him there. Mm-hmm. I think that if Grace Mugabe had been a man, if it was Mugabe's son or brother who had been trying to take over, there would not have been such an angry, misogynist reaction to her.
And her nickname being Gucci Grace as well. That's
the first shopper.
Fairly disparaging. Yeah. But there's lovely, just want to say the detail in this that you talk about in the book. There is the vice president walking through minefields while apparently clutching an $8,000 Louis Vuitton briefcase.
I know, it's extraordinary. Very well written. I would recommend it's called 2 weeks in November. And then finally, let's have a quick look at there's another book there, I think, about...
Yes, that's right. A book called Some Kids I Taught and What They Taught Me by Kate Clanchy is about working in the classroom and really about the children that, against all odds, have really given something to her as much as she trying to teach them. It's a book about class, it says, very much so in this country, and about, you know, beleaguered schools and that sort of thing. But it sounds so interesting, and the diversity of children, from children who have learning difficulties to children at the top of the class. I think it sort of encompasses so much. It looks like so much broader than what it is specifically about. So it looks like a really, really good read, something that I would be very interested in doing, because children are the future. They're the ones who've got to take all this up the mantle.
Oh, I'm feeling a Whitney Houston song coming up.
Oh, yeah.
Sian, just quickly before you go, is there anything you'd recommend to us if we're in London to see or do this week?
This week, well, there is an exhibition. I think you're just going to miss it. The British Library exhibition on hieroglyphs and emojis. That's the one I want to see. I don't think it's quite out yet. But that looks very good, because obviously there is a relation between what we send in our texts and what they used to put on cave walls and what the Egyptians used. And I love that. I think that's wonderful. I love the academicization of One World.
Fantastic. Sian, thank you very much. We'll be hearing about another new exhibition in just a moment. You're listening to Sunday Brunch. finally today, is art always political? In the case of the artist Oliver Jeffers, it would be difficult to separate the two. But that doesn't mean his work is as tense and repetitive as a Brexit negotiation. Quite the opposite. Jeffers' art is often distinctly humorous and it takes a satirical jab at modern culture. In addition to best-selling picture books, his work has been showcased around the world, including the High Line in New York, the Brooklyn Museum and the National Portrait Gallery here in London. Well, his latest exhibition has just been unveiled at the Lezinc Gallery in London's Mayfair. And Oliver is, in fact, on the line. Oliver Jeffers, welcome to Sunday Brunch.
Thank you very much.
Oliver, you work in many different media. So it's sculpture, it's found objects. Just tell us a little bit about what you use.
Well, anything really. I suppose I've never been tied to one particular medium. I've dabbled with oil paint, with watercolour, with collage, found objects, all of the above. And I think I've always just sort of approached whatever it is that I use to make art with by whatever will make the most successful piece.
And this particular exhibition, your new one, is work collected over a long period of time?
Yes and no. There's a couple of pieces in there that are 10 years old, but most of the work has been made, 90% of the work has been made in the last two to three years, really. So it's mostly contemporary work. But it's a range of things. There's some oil painting on paper. There's some painting on top of found objects. There's some just straight up collage and then some drawing.
And let's just break it down then into the sort of different themes, because there are a whole lot of maps and globes. That's sort of playing with ideas of borders and boundaries.
Yeah, that's correct. I suppose I've always been interested in maps for a couple of different reasons. One, I've been blessed with a decent sense of geography, always have been. So I've always been quite curious just to quite know where I am in relation to things. But being Northern Irish, there's always been somewhat of an identity crisis inherent in the Northern Irishness of recent decades, where we're not quite sure whether we're British or Irish or neither or both. And I think particularly recently, it's been a taboo that is larger than the borders of this sort of small statelet. But whenever I moved, I live in Brooklyn and New York, and whenever I moved to the States, I realized that the way in which world maps were drawn there, they severed Asia sort of right down through the center, just so that the USA could appear in the middle. And I realized that Europe took long and gave that, where they made Africa smaller and Greenland larger, just so that Europe could be in the center. So they've always been political tools used to, I think, enhance the importance of the greatness of whoever was paying for the map to be made. And I've started playing about with that in a lot of ways recently, especially after doing some research about the overview effect, which is something that happens to astronauts whenever they get far enough away from the Earth to realize that, you know, that's not obvious. There's a particular up or down. So, you know, that north is at the top of the map is completely arbitrary. But also that the idea of nationalism and borders are a completely man-made construct that aren't noticeable once you get far enough away. And that what is noticeable is that Earth is a superorganism, a single system. And it fundamentally changes all of these human beings when they come back down to Earth with their approach to politics.
And the overview effect, of course, is also your immersive installation on New York's High Line.
Yeah, and that was installed in January, and it was used to, the timing was to coincide with the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 8 mission, which went up, and they took the first photograph of the Earth as a single object. And so that was 50 years ago, just this past Christmas. And to think about that nobody, this idea of the Earth as this sort of green and blue ball floating in space is a relatively new one. You know, the whole way up until past World War II, we knew in theory what the Earth might look like, but nobody was really sure. So this, the idea of the marble is pretty recent, when humanity looked at itself for the first time in 1968. So that exhibition was there for a while, and it was a geographically accurate model of Earth and the Moon in size and distance relation to each other, because it's the only object that's, the Moon is the only object that's even remotely close in outer space, and it's I think it's striking how far away it actually is whenever you think about it in terms of scale and context. It's a quarter of a million miles away. And at the scale of the at the Highline Park, the Earth was 8 feet in diameter, the Moon was 2 feet in diameter, and they were 166 feet apart. And the nearest other object to Earth at that scale would have been, I think it was Mars, and it would have been about a mile and a half away. And it was, you know, the size of a beach ball. So that's just how empty and alone the solar system really is. So I've in this in LaZinc, I have created a mini version of this that the Earth is 20 inches and I think the Moon is about 50 feet away. But it still gives the it's all within the gallery, so it just does give you that brief sense of just the space that is in space.
Now you've also got representatives, I suppose you could call it, of your disaster series. Tell us about this, your found land and seascapes.
I've been doing these for years where it's in New York. There's a wonderful system called free cycling where rather than just own something in the bin that you think somebody else might get a use out of, you would set it on the street on trash night and rubbish night, and people tend to just pick things up that are just left in the street. That's the rules. And I've been picking up these old prints and old paintings for years, and mostly ones look like they're the backdrop for something else to happen on. And and I would do that. I would just go in and I would normally paint the first thing that that I would think of in there. After about a dozen of them, I realized that I tended to be painting disaster scenes onto them, often the Titanic sinking in strange locations. And we were coming up to a period a couple of years ago where it was the centenary of the sinking of the Titanic that was celebrated in Northern Ireland here. And I thought that was sort of, there was something quite telling about that, where the centenary of the sinking was celebrated rather than the centenary of it being built. But it struck me that with all of these interventions, these disaster paintings, it's, you know, I think it's a comment on how society isn't really all that satisfied with tranquility. And we do seek out drama. You know, why whenever there's an accident on one side of the motorway, the traffic slows down on both. It might go some way towards explaining reality TV. We do look for drama in things rather than peace and quiet.
Absolutely. Now, social commentary obviously is a big, big part of your work. I loved, I saw a picture of the passport you'd done. Just tell us a little bit about that British passport.
I think, it's called the Statelet of Things. And I think in a lot of the, at the time of the vote for the, to leave the European referendum, ever since known as Brexit, what really struck me was how little talk there was at the time. And how probably little awareness there was in any voters' minds other than those here in Northern Ireland, where there was an awareness that Northern Ireland was even part of the United Kingdom. Even when I was driving through London last weekend and was all of those the pro-Brexit protesters out, I wondered just how many of them were actually thinking about this, the border in Ireland that would separate, that does separate the north from the south, or it used to anyway, and just, you know, what a hard fought for peace that was, and what a tragic reality that absolutely nothing to do with us, that has been thrust back into a reality, a potential reality. And so the most striking thing was just how little it was brought up, how little it was thought of. And so this passport called the Statelet of Things, I've repainted a British passport, crossed out European Union, and it just says the United Kingdom of Great Britain and .. I think, is there supposed to be another bit?
Oliver, that's great. Thank you so much. And Oliver's exhibition is on at LaZinc in Mayfair. And that's all for this edition of Sunday Brunch. Our producer's Ben Rylan and our studio manager is Sarah Miles. Coming up, the sessions at Midori House. I'm Georgina Godwin. That's Sunday Brunch. Enjoy your day.